I now ask that you give our careful and prayerful attention to our brother and apostle, Brian McAdoo.
Thank you, Bob. I was kind of tickled, I guess, about a commercial that I hear constantly on the radio, on the television, for the last few months. And that the commercial is now is the time to buy a new SUV or full-size pickup truck. This is the best time ever to make that purchase. The prices are so low that it's going to pay for your gas for the years to come. Now, my question is to you. How many of you, some of us drive full-size pickup trucks and SUVs, and we know what the problem is in that. And they're trying to sell you on the idea that, we're going to take care of you. We got you covered here. Now, how many of you think that the car company is looking out for your very best interest? Raise your hand. How many of you think the car company is actually trying to help you through this gas crisis? Raise your hand. How many of you go down there and hang out with the guys at the car company because they're so nice? Raise your hand. Fact is, truth is, it's a gimmick. They are trying to influence you. They're trying to pretend to be doing you a big favor. You don't have to worry about gas because we're going to sell you this car that will get 6 miles to the gallon. So cheap that it's going to pay for your gas for the next years to come. We are your buddies. We are your friend. We are rescuing you from this gas crisis. So you're going to lose money if you don't come down right now today and buy a full-size pickup from us. Truth is, they got them half price. Why do they have them half price? Because they can't get rid of them. They are paperweights on their parking lot. And they are simply trying to deceive you. Deception. The crux of my sermon is not the evils of buying an SUV or a full-size pickup truck. I drive an SUV, or my wife drives it a lot. We pay the gas mileage. It's not about buying cars, but the crux of my sermon is the influence you receive is not always the best. And you have to be careful. You have to be careful because people are going to try to deceive you. They are going to try to trick you. They are going to try to make you think that they are looking out for you. And that's not always the case. My sermon really is one verse. It's in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. But if you begin in chapter 15 of 1 Corinthians, at verse 1, Paul is writing to the Corinthians, those in Corinth. And he's speaking to them about the resurrection of the dead. And he tells them that he has explained this concept that the saints will rise from the dead. He's explained this to them. And he speaks boldly about it. And he says, I preach to you and explain this to you in vain because you're not remembering my words. He lays out to them how Christ died and how Christ died that he could raise up again from the death to eternal life. And how there were many witnesses to the crucifixion and to the death of Jesus Christ and to the resurrection of Jesus Christ. And how he told them this and convinced them that and shared the truth of the resurrection of the dead with them. But Paul's concern, and the reason Paul is writing them and re-emphasizing this great ordinance and this great truth of the gospel about the resurrection of the dead is because the people in Corinth began listening to other people. They began to listen to people that were telling them and teaching them against the concept, the belief that there will be a resurrection of the dead and that Christ rose from the dead. You know, there were these smart guys in Corinth. Smart guys that came and told them, it's impossible. Think about it. It's impossible for somebody that has died, lost all their brain functions, all their body functions, began to decompose, to raise up again from the dead. It can't happen. Explain it. How would it happen? How can this such a thing happen? We are smarter. Why are you so dumb to believe such a concept of that? That's what these people were telling them. And they begin to doubt the very truths that they had, what Paul had taught them. You know, it's like the smart guys of the world today. They're throughout the churches and throughout the television media and the televangelists and the people that call themselves scholars that say, it's impossible for a virgin birth. Yeah, your Bible says it, but we know that couldn't have happened. These are men of God, and they're telling the people and the congregations, it didn't happen. They say, it's impossible to rise from the dead. Jesus never rose from the dead. He never said he would rise from the dead. He never said he would return. It's like the people today that say it's impossible for God, a supreme being, to create the heavens and the earth and to create man. You know, we have to be able to explain it. It's through evolution. We're smart people. Don't believe this funny, silly stories about these things. So the apostle had to come in once again and testify and teach them all the truths about the resurrection of the dead. The facts of it, the witnesses to it, the concept behind it, the promises of God that it would come about and it would happen. But the apostle, he closes his argument about the resurrection of the dead with a caution, with an exhortation, with a reprimand to them. A caution against the dangerous conversations that the Corinthians were having with other people, with bad men that wanted to destroy them, wanted to deceive them. Men, possibly of loose lives and principles, people that did not believe and trust the very truths of the gospel. And so in verse 33, after his long 32 verses of dissertation about the resurrection of the dead, he makes a statement. He says, be not deceived. Evil communication corrupt good manners. This, well, look at this verse. This text, this verse, this one little verse, really seems a little out of place for the other 32 verses that preceded it. The topic in chapter 15 is strictly the resurrection of the dead and his preaching the truth concerning it. And this verse, all of a sudden, you get to verse 33, and it jumps out. It stands alone. It's like, it's almost like he quoted something else or injected a standalone statement. And that's why, you know, a guy like me can take this one verse and yank it out of this text of the resurrection of the dead, and it's a standalone statement. It's almost like it's a quote. And it seems that way because, any guesses? It is a quote. It's a quote from somebody else. He was preaching his sermon, and then he quoted somebody else. This standalone statement. He quoted it from a Greek comic poet named Meander. And Meander, in some degree, was familiar to the people there. And he shows that he was familiar with this Greek poet, Meander. Meander was a celebrated comic poet that lived in Athens in 250 B.C. And today, only a few pieces of his work. He had almost 200 poetic writings, but only a few small fragments of his work still exist. But this is one of them. His writings were thought to be full of elegance and refined wit and sensible observations. And they believe that that Paul probably used his Greek writings because he was talking to Greeks, and they would appreciate the fact that he knew about this guy, and he threw the statement in there. I have to question, you know, how Meander was, he really had sensible observations and good wit about him when you find out that he drowned himself at the age of 52 because one of his rival writers was getting more applause for his writing than he was, and he was so upset by it, he drowned himself over it. But Paul took this statement, this standalone statement, to try to make a point to those in Corinth. So let's go back at what Paul was trying to get across. In this quote, I'm not going to talk to you about the resurrection of the dead. I'm going to talk to you about what Paul was trying to make the people understand when he quoted Meander. After his long dissertation on why they should believe there would be a resurrection of dead and what they should and why they should believe his words, he warns them. He says, he begins, the very first thing he begins, be not deceived. And then there's a colon. Am I understanding with that colon? The next thought is a little bit separate from this first thing. The first part of this is a standalone statement too. Be not deceived. Don't be deceived. The next part, he's going to tell you how you're going to be deceived. But right now, he's warning them. Don't be deceived. I've told you the truth. You understood the truth. When I left here, you had it. You know what it is. So deception means you've gone away from that truth. If you look at that word deceived, it means, properly, it means cause to roam from safety. Roam away from the safety of the truth, to go astray, to err, to seduce, to wander, to be out of the way. You know, we could talk about that for the gospel of Jesus Christ. Here you are, a people that have sat here and you have learned and you have received the truth over and over again. You have been taught. He's telling you, don't wander away from the safety of the truth in which you have received. Don't go astray from it. Don't let influence take you away, cause you to roam, to go out of the way of this truth which you received. Be not deceived by false teachers and their smooth and plausible arguments. You know, there are people out there that are smooth talkers. There's people out there that are very educated, and they can talk to you for a long time about the creation, about biology and geology and all these things that you see and you believe because you believe in God. And they could smooth talk you out of these beliefs that you have. Possibly some of those that were talking to Corinthians. Possibly some were of those that said there was no resurrection of the dead were men of loose morals or immoral lives. We don't know. We don't know if that's why they came to them and told them that. But what we do know is they were trying to influence and convince the Corinthians of false ideas. the false idea that there would be no resurrection of the dead. In that chapter, Paul says, you know, if Christ did not rise from the dead, then we're not going to rise from the dead. And if we're not going to rise from the dead, we're all wasting our time. If you don't want to believe in the resurrection of the dead, don't believe in anything. And so these people were trying to drag them completely out of the truth of the gospel. They could have been family members. They could have been old friends of these people before they converted to Christianity. They could have been leaders of groups of other fractions of the gospel. There was a group that was very popular around the area at that time. They were called the Gnostics. Don't confuse the Gnostics with the agnostics. Agnostics means you don't know anything. The Gnostics means they thought they knew everything. They were in pursuit of knowledge. We want to discover more. We want to understand more. We want to increase our knowledge. It sounds like the scholars today, doesn't it? We want to know more. So the Gnostics were men searching for greater knowledge, and they were like the self-proclaimed scholars of today, which no longer believe in anything. They've taught themselves to the point they no longer believe in the very fundamentals of the Bible, very fundamentals of the doctrine, very fundamentals of Christ's promises and God's promises to us. They don't believe in any of it because they are of higher knowledge now. Yet they call themselves scholars. And what are these scholars doing to you today? If you want to know, watch some of these specials on television sometime about, you know, what was Christ really doing? Where was he really living? You know, what really about John the Baptist? What about the... They'll tell you all kinds of negative things. Well, none of these things happened. That's what they're going to try to convince you. And there were people in Corinth trying to do the same thing to them. And that's why Paul says, be not deceived. Don't let somebody uproot you from the truth and carry you away into something else. We don't know exactly who it was that was deceiving them and telling them that, but there were people doing it. And I don't think today that there's any less deception in this world trying to uproot us and change us and rescue us from the very gospel of Jesus Christ. And that's why it's a good standalone statement. He wasn't talking just about the resurrection. He's talking about the whole concept. And so am I. We cannot be deceived. We cannot let this intelligent side of the world, our friends, our family, that is against the truth, deceive us. We can't let the scholars, the schools, the teachers, the professors, the television shows that are out there just every day that will show you why all these things couldn't happen. The televangelists. You know, I have to feel for Paul. You know, I've gone to foreign countries, just like Paul. You know, he went to Corinth. That's not his homeland. He went there, he taught them, they understood, he baptized and he formed a church, and then later he gets news, these people are not believing this anymore. I went and I started a congregation in Uganda. We had a group there, we had a church there, we had a congregation of people that believed our doctrines and believed the truth. Come back 6 months later, other people had gone in there, none of them believed it again. Were deceived because I wasn't there constantly with them. But you know, I'm not going to be there. You young people, your parents are not going to be there. Your old people, your children are not going to be there. You're not always going to have somebody there to protect you. You have to not be deceived yourselves. You have to be convinced of the truth which you have. And you have to protect yourselves from those who will deceive you. And after the colon, he says, be not deceived, colon. Then he tells us why. Who's going to deceive us? What is one of the things that's going to deceive us the most? And it says, evil communications. Evil communications. Evil communications corrupts. Evil communications corrupt good manners, is what he said. That's what's going to deceive us. Now I'm going to break down this for us because it's not all it seems to be. It's bigger than what it seems to be. Because when you just read that, evil communications corrupt good manners, it sounds like if you talk bad, you're not going to have good manners. You know, it's like going through the mall and having a bunch of kids over there using bad language, and you think, well, they're a bunch of rude kids. You know, and that's not what he's saying. It's bigger than that. It's bigger than that. The word communication here means bring together. Companionship. Close contact. To converse. But in reference to here, it's not only discourse only, but the contact and the companionship that you have with others. If it's evil, evil togetherness, evil companionship, evil contact is a problem. The warning implied that there were some people who were endeavoring to corrupt their minds of the simple gospel. And that's what made them evil. They were trying to remove them from the truth in which they knew. The sentiment of this passage is that the contact with evil-minded people, or a close friendship and conversation of those that hold erroneous opinions to the truth of the gospel because of their evil speaking, would tend to corrupt the simplicity of your faith and pervert your views and their views of the truth of the gospel. And thus, it would corrupt their lives, and it would corrupt their opportunity for the plan of salvation to be a part of their life. So likewise today, it's very important for us to carefully choose our friends, carefully choose our companions, carefully choose who we associate with on a regular basis. For the younger guys, choose who we hang out with. We have to be careful about it. Let me give you an example. I'm going to give you two examples. I'm going to give you an example of poor choices of who you will be companions with, who you will associate with, and I'll give you an example of a good choice. Let me give you an example. Solomon, he's a good example of how keeping bad company can destroy you. He was known, if you start looking at some of reference books and history books about Solomon, I found it very interesting because almost invariably they will say Solomon may have been one of the greatest kings that Israel ever had. But at the same time, he was one of the worst kings Israel ever had. You know, I'm not sure that's the kind of reputation I want to leave this world with. You know, well, he was one of the greatest men that ever walked into the Church of Christ, but he's also one of the worst men that ever walked in the Church of Christ. You know, you could take half of that. Maybe either half would be better than both. But, you know, here he had both qualities about him. Think of the advantage he began with. He had the possessions of David's throne and the riches of the world. He had power over God's chosen people. And not only did he have power over them, they loved him. And they would follow him. And they respected him. And he possessed the blessings and the gifts of God, some of those gifts beyond measure of any other man that has walked the face of this earth. He had a great beginning. He had a great opportunity. But let's see what the scriptures say about him. I'm going to read in Nehemiah chapter 13. I'm going to read verse 26 and 27. It says there, did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? Yet among many nations was there no king like him, who was beloved of his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, even him did outlandish women cause to sin. Shall we then hearken unto you to do all this great evil, to transgress against our God, to marry strange wives? I know some of you men out there are thinking that there's others in this congregation that have strange wives, but that's not what Nehemiah was talking about, okay? He's not talking like you're thinking. He's talking about Solomon having strange wives because Solomon took the wife of the daughter of Pharaoh, married her, and put a pagan to sit on the throne of David as a queen over Israel. He became a polygamist and took wives from other pagan cultures, usually for the reason to make allies or to gain favor with other nations and countries or tribes of people, just to gain power and favor with them, to make his kingdom stronger. And they were pagans. They didn't believe the truths that Solomon believed. They didn't believe in the true and living God and the one God that Israel believed in. So I'm going to turn to 1 Kings chapter 11. I'm going to read verse 1. I'm going to begin in verse 1. It says, but King Solomon loved many strange women, together with the daughter of Pharaoh, women of the Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Zidians, and Hittites, of the nations concerning which he, the Lord, said unto the children of Israel, ye shall not go into them, neither shall ye come in unto them, for surely they will turn away your heart after their gods. Solomon clave unto these in love, and he had 700 wives, princesses, and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. For it came to pass when Solomon was old, that his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not perfect with the Lord his God, as was the heart of David his father. His association, the people that he married, the people that he stayed with, you know, we won't even get into the subject of his concubines and his princesses and stuff, but it was the association of others that had different ideas, different beliefs, pagan beliefs, false ideas, and they turned his heart against all that he knew, all that he believed, all that he stood for. This is the man that built the temple to the Lord, the one and single God, and yet when he was old, his wives had turned his heart from them to other gods. It was the company. It was the communication, the companionship that he kept that deceived him and turned him away. So let's contrast that. Lehi, he was speaking to his sons and the men that came with him out of Israel into the promised land. And we're going to turn to 2 Nephi chapter 1. And I have kind of a long reading because I just want you to get into this story. And I'm going to begin in verse 39. I'm going to read through verse 56. And it's here he's talking to his sons. The point I want to make is clear down in verse 55 or 56, I believe. But let's start in verse 39. Here Lehi speaking to his sons, he says, shake off the chains which you are bound, and come forth out of obscurity, and arise from the dust. Rebel no more against your brother, whose views have been glorious and who have kept the commandments from that time that we left Jerusalem and who hath been an instrument in the hands of God in bringing us forth into the promised land. He's talking to his sons that are being stubborn and rebelling against their brother Nephi. Nephi, he's saying here, has kept the commandments, kept the views correct. He's been an instrument in God's hand to keep them on the straight and narrow path since they left Israel. So here's a good influence, Lehi. He says, for we, were it not for him, we must have perished with hunger in the wilderness. Nevertheless, ye sought to take away his life, yea, and he has suffered much sorrow because of you. And I exceedingly fear and tremble because of you, lest ye shall suffer again. For behold, ye have accused him that he sought power and authority over you. But I know that he hath not sought for power nor authority over you, but he has sought the glory of God and your own eternal welfare. And ye have murmured because he hath been pain unto you, plain unto you. Ye say that he hath not sharpened you. Ye say that he hath used sharpness. Ye say that he hath been angry with you. But behold, his sharpness was the sharpness and the power of the word of God which was in him. And that which ye call anger was the truth according to that which is in God, which he could not restrain, manifesting boldly concerning your iniquities. And it must needs be that the power of God must be with him, even unto his commanding you that ye must obey. But behold, it was not him, but it was the Spirit of the Lord which was in him, which opened his mouth to utterance, that he could not shut it. And now my son Laban, and also Lemuel and Sam, and also my sons, which are the sons of Ishmael, behold, if ye will hearken unto the voice of Nephi, ye shall not perish. And if ye will hearken, unto him, I leave unto you a blessing, yea, even my first blessing. But if ye will not hearken unto him, I take away my first blessing, yea, even my blessing, and it shall rest upon him. Now I'm going to go down. I think it's verse 55. It says, and now, Zoram, I speak unto you. Zoram is just a guy that they brought along with them. He was Laban's temple guard, and they just brought him along. He said, no, now, Zoram, I speak unto you. Behold, thou art a servant of Laban. Nevertheless, thou hast brought out of the land of Jerusalem, and I know that thou art a true friend unto my son Nephi forever. A true friend. Here is someone that would listen, that would look out for Nephi, that cared for him, that supported the truth and the ideas that Nephi was doing. He said, he is a true friend. Wherefore, because thou hast been faithful, thy seed shall be blessed with his seed, that they dwell in prosperity long upon the face of the land. We all know the story. We all know what happened to Laman and Lemuel. They did not become a friend. They fought against all the truths. And they had their hearts hardened. They moved out. They became wild, savage people. But Zoram was a true friend. He believed. He kept a good companionship, a good friendship with the truth. And he received blessings. Received the blessing. And Solomon, he chose poorly, bad company. And his went down into history as not believing God, to being a pagan, to being one of the worst kings of Israel. So this idea of companionship, choosing proper companionship, choosing proper people to be with, to be there amongst you that can influence you is very important. You know, Paul readdressed this very same subject, not quoting Meander this time, but he addressed the same philosophy about keeping bad company. how detrimental it could be to you in his second letter to the Corinthians. Now, we often use this text I'm going to read here to counsel people about marriage. But Paul's words are really bigger and more expansive than that. In 2 Corinthians chapter 6, I'm going to read verses 14 through 17. And it's going to be a very familiar verse to you. It says, be not unequally yoked. I looked up that word yoke just to make sure I understood what he was saying here. It means to associate discordingly with. If you're not on the same page, if you're not in the same belief system, then you associate discordantly. It says, be not unequally yoked together with unbelievers. I looked on that chapter to see if he was talking specifically about marriage. He's not. He's talking to all of us. Don't be unequally yoked with unbelievers. It says, for what fellowship hath righteousness with unrighteousness? And what communication hath light with darkness? And what concord hath Christ with Belial? And what part hath he that believeth with an infidel? And what agreement hath the temple of God with idols? Here he gave us all kinds of examples. You know, none of these things coexist together. And so he's telling them again in his second letter, don't try to coexist with those that are going to try to influence and persuade you and teach you false ideas. He says, for you are the temple of the living God, and God has said, I will dwell in them and walk in them, and I will be their God, and they shall be my people. Then Paul says, wherefore come out from among them, and be ye separate, saith the Lord, and touch not the unclean thing, and I will receive you. You know, the choice of bad companionship, the choice of bad company, first off, it shows an inclination towards evil. It shows this idea within you to want to be a part of bad actions. If we take it to the extreme, just bad people. If we want to associate it, it kind of shows our heart leaning towards it. It's like Lot's wife when he told him, don't look back. You know, the reason she looked back is her heart was still there. I had a laugh, you know, when I was in the police department, I knew some guys that rode motorcycles. And they, you know, there's policemen. And they were all excited because they were going to go to Sturgis, the big Sturgis rally. You know, well, if you don't know it yet, I do ride a motorcycle. But I have no desire to go to the Sturgis rally because all the other people at the Sturgis rally are the same guys that I was putting in jail. Why would I want to go hang out with them? Why would I want to go associate with them? Well, you know, I can't help but wonder if those guys that wanted to go and hang out with them, you know, a policeman was just their job. Their heart truly was to be one of them, to be like them. To be, you know, that's the way it is, you know, if we just want to hang out in the bar, even though we don't drink, it's because we really want to be in that environment. That's who we really want to be. So it shows this tendency, this inclination towards evil ways. Paul, when he says, be not unequally yoked, evil communication or evil company, he doesn't imply this is going to all take place suddenly. But it's going to be a gradual change in your life. The influence will gradually wear you down. Their influence will gradually take hold in your mind. You'll start thinking like them. And that's why he says, be careful. Don't associate with it. It brings you a little closer to the world and the mindset of the world. And it makes you become friends with the world and friends with the philosophies of those that do not believe like we do. Do not believe the truth of the gospel. And it's a rarity today for churches to believe the truth of the gospel. You have to be careful. It goes with the modern saying, a man is known by the company he keeps. We have to choose our friends carefully. Concerning friendship, I have a quote here from the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. This is as close to a philosophy class as I have ever gotten and probably ever will. But it defines friendship. And that's what he's talking about, companions, you know. Friendship. Friendship, as understood here, is a distinctive personal relationship that is grounded, okay, here we go, that is grounded in a concern on the part of each friend and for the welfare of the other, for the other's sake, and that involves some degree of intimacy. As such, friendship is undoubtedly central to our lives, in part because the special concern we have for our friends must have a place within a broader set of concerns, including moral concerns, and in part because our friends can help shape who we are as persons. You know, that's why we have to be careful. We choose our friends. They shape who we are as people. They are involved in our moral concern. I will get to that a little more in a minute. But I'd like to quote one other person. You might have heard of his name. George Washington. He said, associate yourself with men of good quality if you esteem your own reputation. Tis better to be alone than in bad company. I think he was very wise in that. Very wise. It's better to be alone than in bad company. Associate yourself with people with good qualities if you want to watch out for your own reputation. You know, there are many good people in this world. I'm not telling you don't associate with anybody that's not a part of the Church of Christ. But if your friend is trying to mold you away from the truth, is trying to steer you away from the truth, is trying to influence you and teach you that things are bad in the beliefs that you have, they're going to make an impact upon you. If your friends are doing evil things, they're going to make an impact on you. They're going to taint your reputation. Do you remember why we should avoid this bad company? Let me remind you, let me tell you, or rather Paul, quoting Miranda's statement that lasted over 300 years, he says, bad company corrupts good manners. It corrupts them. This word corrupt means to shrivel, or wither. See, I got those two words together. I just, you know, saved us some time by putting those two words together. Shrivel or wither, that is to spoil by any process, or to ruin, or defile, or to destroy. It's going to wither away. It's going to destroy. It's going to ruin. And this word ruin is for moral influence. Ruin our good manners. Good here means useful, better, good, gracious, kind. Useful in moral or manners. So it's going to ruin our good manners. Now, I got to this word manners, you know. What was he saying? Today's meaning of the word manners means good etiquette. You know, it means you don't belch in public, you don't pick your nose and stuff like that. That's what we use for manners today, you know. You don't put your hands on the table or reach across or sneeze at the table without covering your mouth. You know, those things. That's how we use the word today. But this Greek word is a strengthened plural form of the original word, which means moral habits. Moral habits, not the physical habits you have, but the moral habits that you have. Paul was implying our virtue, our integrity, the high caliber of person that we are, a desirable person of righteous qualities. He's saying if you have bad company, it is going to shrivel away your useful, high qualities of a righteous person. Your good manners, your virtue. Bad company is going to destroy your virtue. So I ask you to apply these ideas to making friends in school, making friends at work. What kind of life do they have? What kind of influence do they have? What kind of morality and ideas do they have? Apply these ideas to picking a mate for your life. Where are they going to take you? Are they going to take you like Solomon, or are they going to take you to the blessings of God? Apply this to idea, these principles to who you spend your time with. What are they going to do for you? Avoid any that are contrary to your beliefs and moral values and fight against them. Notoriously, people today are going to try to rescue you from the restoration. If you're working at work and you tell somebody you believe in the Book of Mormon, some of those people are going to try to rescue you from this evil belief in the Book of Mormon. They're going to try to rescue you from the restoration. And the rest of them are going to try to rescue you just from Christianity alone because you're a weakling. You don't need that. That's what the world is trying to do to us. And you, like the Corinthians, you can be pulled away into a different direction. They can cause your faith to be weak. Avoid them that are trying to persuade you against proper worship, against the Book of Mormon, against coming to church, against doing that which is right. Even if those are family members, even if they are disgruntled members or ex-members that are trying to influence you against the church or the ministry of the church, avoid them. I'd like to read a warning that Christ said in Luke chapter 12. I'm going to read verses 1 through 5. It says, in the meantime, when there were gathered together an innumerable multitude of people, insomuch that they trod upon one another, he began to say unto his disciples, first of all, Be aware ye of the leaven of the Pharisees, which is hypocrisy. For there is nothing covered that shall not be revealed, neither hid that shall not be shown. Therefore, whatsoever you have spoken in darkness shall be heard in the light, and that which ye have spoken in the ear of in closets shall be proclaimed upon the housetops. And I say unto you, my friends, be not afraid of them which kill the body, and after that have no more that they can do, but I forewarn you whom ye shall fear. Fear him which hath, after he hath killed, hath power to cast into hell. Yea, I say unto you, fear him. Don't be afraid of those that can kill our body. Be afraid of those that have the power of Satan that will influence you away from the truth of the gospel and cast you into hell. But what I was really interested in is he says, Be aware, ye of the leaven of the Pharisees. You know, that's kind of a strange word, you know. Be aware of the yeast of the Pharisees. Be aware of the rising up of the, you know, what's he saying here? It's a strange word, but this word leaven comes from a Greek word which means to boil up, to ferment. So that means just exactly what we thought about it. But what does that mean? What if it boils up and it ferments? You have to look at the process that he's talking about. Leaven permeates all that is around it. You take a big lump of water and flour, a big wad of it, and set it there and just leave it there, it's going to do nothing. But if you took just a little chunk of leavened flour, some that had yeast in it, a little piece the size of my thumb, and stuck it down there in the middle of that, it would permeate completely through that lump, and the whole lump would rise up. The whole thing would be influenced. Jesus used that also as an example in Luke 13:21. It says, it is like leaven which a woman took and hid up in 3 measures of meal till the whole was leavened. It's exactly what he's talking about, the influence of the Pharisees. He told them to be aware of it. Be careful of it. When he spoke his revelation to John in the book of Revelation, chapter 18, verse 2, he spoke to the world about being careful of the influence of the evil. I'm going to begin in verse 2 and read through verse 4. It says, and he cried mightily with a strong voice, saying, Babylon the great is fallen, and become the habitation of devils and a hold of every foul spirit and cage of every unclean and hateful bird. For all nations have drunk the wine of the wrath of her fornication. And the kings of the earth have committed fornication with her. And the merchants of the earth are waxed rich through the abundance of her delicacies. Everybody's influenced with this Babylon. They're all enjoying the things of life through this Babylon. But in verse 4 it says, and I heard another voice from heaven saying, come out of her, my people, that ye shall not be partakers of her sin, that ye will not receive of her plagues. Come out of her. Have no association with her. Don't be companions with her. Come out of her. She's going to corrupt good manners. That's what he's called us to do. That's what we have to remember. Just like the Corinthians. Don't let evil influence. It's easy to see when it's a car dealer talking to you about it. They're going to save you all this money on an SUV. But when it's your friend that's sitting there all the time whispering in your ear, you don't need this, you don't need that, don't believe that. Your ministry or not true ministry, whatever they're saying, if they're against the truth that you have been taught, don't company with them. It's better to be alone than to be with an evil person. In verse 34, he leaves Miranda's statement and he says, awake to righteousness. Awake righteously, sin not, sin no more. Rouse yourself, break off the sins by repentance. Renounce and forsake every evil way. Correct whatever is amiss. And do not by idleness or even stupidity be led away into such conversations and principles that will sap your Christian hopes and corrupt your Christian practices and beliefs. I think Paul's words to the Corinthians are good words for us to remember because it's something that we deal with on a daily basis. May God bless us each in that endeavor. Thank you.